History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. On August 29, 1973, a routine dive to the telecommunication cable that snakes along the Atlantic seabed went badly wrong. Pisces 3, with Roger Chapman and Roger Mallinson on board, had tried to surface when a catastrophic fault suddenly sent the mini-submarine tumbling to the ocean bed. Badly damaged, buried nose-first in a bed of sand with crushing pressure outside, the submarine and the two men were now trapped a half-mile under the ocean surface. Rescue was just 3 days away with just 2 days' worth of oxygen. Today's guest is Stephen McGinty, author of The Dive, the untold story of the world's deepest submarine rescue. In our discussion, he reconstructs the minute-by-minute race against time that took place first to locate Pisces 3, and then to execute the deepest rescue in maritime history. And this event shows how Britain, America, and Canada pooled their resources into a, what they called a Brotherhood of the Sea, dedicated to stopping the ocean depths from claiming two of their own. And at the heart of the story is the relationship between Roger Chapman, the ebullient former naval officer, and Roger Mallinson, the studious engineer sealed in a sunken sarcophagus. For 3 days, they'd battle against despair, fading hope, and carbon dioxide poisoning, trying against all odds to be rescued. This is a really entertaining story, and I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Stephen McGinty. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me, Scott.
Well, we're going to look at a topic which has fascinated me, sometimes morbidly, and that has to do with activity far below the surface of the ocean, in this case, a submarine rescue. But in the past, I've read accounts of the first trip to the bottom of the Mariana Trench, which was done in the 1960s. And I forget who did it, but it was two explorers that at some point there was a crack in the window of their vessel. And I was internally clenched because I can imagine what happens if your vessel breaks when you're that far below the surface, and thousands of times the pressure of the surface happens and your body would crush to something between, I don't know, a gelatinous blob, or you would die, and you would die in a horrific way. So it's a really interesting topic, but what first got you interested in this general research topic and this submarine rescue in particular?
Sure. Well, I've always been fascinated by the sea. Ever since I was a kid, and you know, we used to stay on Sunday night to watch The Undersea World of Jacques Cousteau. It's always been an area of fascination for me. And ironically, the first time I heard about this story was on a cruise ship a number of years ago, when one of the ship's captain was talking about how he remembered being involved vaguely, tangentially, with a rescue, and I'd never even heard of it. And this was just bubbling around in the back of my subconscious. And then it popped up maybe 5 or 6 years ago. There was a little article about an anniversary that cropped up about this rescue. And I'd previously written a book called Fire in the Night about the Piper Alpha disaster, which was the world's worst offshore oil rig disaster. And it's again a disaster offshore at sea. And I'd always been fascinated by the kind of concept of a team coming together to put themselves at risk to try and rescue people. And the rescue of Pisces 3, when I started digging under the surface, just became a kind of a fascinating story. I mean, the broad outline of it is that in 1973, there was a small two-man sub known as the Pisces 3, and there was two men on board. There was Roger Mallinson and there was Roger Chapman. And what they were doing was they'd been hired. Their company was Vickers Oceanics, and Vickers Oceanics was part of the giant Vickers Shipbuilding Group, which had been a great figure, a great industrial titan in Britain during the late 19th century and early 20th century. And it had expanded out into the idea of small submarines doing commercial work. And what they were doing was they were effectively burying the Cantac cable, which was the transatlantic cable that ran from Canada to Britain. And it had been buried, it had been laid previously. And what they were doing was there were sections in just off the coast in Canada and just off the coast of Britain where the water was shallow enough, very, very deep, but still shallow enough for fishermen's nets and hooks to possibly go down and drag it. So there was a whole task of effectively going down to a depth of about 1,600 feet, so a third of a mile down in these tiny submarines, and effectively digging a trench that the cable would fall into, and then the sand and the ocean floor would sweep over it effectively. And what happened on this day in August 1973 was they'd spent 8 hours down on the Atlantic floor digging a small tunnel to bury this cable. Then they rose back up to the surface and they were looking forward to cooked breakfast, hot shower. It'd been a long, they worked all through the night, and they got to the surface, and the system was that a diver would go on top of the submarine and he would connect a hook and the submarine would be towed back to the mothership. And that was the procedure. What happened was a catastrophic and absolutely out of the odds kind of failure, effectively. The genesis of it, without going into massive amounts of detail, was a rope from the team latched around a bolt on the surface of the hatch. And when it went taut, it pulled the nut. The nut flipped because of pressure underneath the aft sphere of the ship of the submarine. The lid effectively flipped open, and suddenly hundreds of pounds and eventually tons of seawater flooded into the back of the submarine. The submarine then began to sink, and it hit 120 feet, and then the tow rope that it was attached to stopped it, and it began to swing really violently. And what happened then was Roger Mallinson spent 2 or 3 frantic minutes trying to loosen the weight that was on the submarine. There was a kind of large weight that was attached to it, and he managed to get that off a split second before the rope snapped and the submarine plummeted 1,600 feet and smashed into the bottom of the Atlantic. Now, the way to imagine this, if you're a listener, is try and imagine you and your best friend are in effectively a large telephone box. Imagine a telephone box, slightly bigger, close the door on it, and imagine this telephone box is sitting at the bottom of the Empire State Building. Then imagine that everything up to 10 floors above the Empire State Building is flooded with seawater. Then turn out the lights, and then start losing air, and then realize that rescue is 3 days away. And that's the position that Roger Chapman and Roger Mallinson were in. It was when they touched down, they didn't think that they were going to be able to be rescued. They were at a depth deeper than any previous submarine rescue. They were also 120 miles off the coast of Ireland, so they weren't in mid-Atlantic, but they certainly weren't by the shore. And what was really problematic was that the way the submarine operated was, this is a very analog story. This is not a digital world we're living in. This is 1973. So how did they know where the submarine was? Very simple. They had a buoy. The buoy was attached to a rope, and the buoy sat on the surface, and the rope was attached to the submarine. So what happens when they get to the surface? The first thing the diver does is unhook the buoy. So when that plummeted, they saw roughly where it dropped down, but they had no idea where it had landed. As I say in the book, it was a needle in a haystack. They knew where the haystack was. They just didn't know where the needle was. But what's wonderful about this story is that anyone who knows about the sea and is fascinated with it, there's a great thing known as the Brotherhood of the Sea. And the idea is that if you are in trouble in the sea, all bets are off. Any other ships that have missions to do, everyone comes together, because everyone who operates offshore appreciates that one day that call could come out and they could be the recipient, they could be the person in need. So what happened was that Vickers Oceanics put out a call. They called the Canadians, who had a rescue another Pisces ship, and they called the Americans. And both the Canadians and the Americans came to their aid. And the book is the story of that rescue, effectively.
Well, to back up a bit, if I try to pretend I know what I'm talking about, I'll reveal my ignorance very quickly. So I'll say that when I was in university, I did take a scuba diving course. This was how rigorous my education was. And I knew some of the basics, like Boyle's gas law, that as pressure on a gas increases, volume decreases. And what that means in layman's terms is if you're more than 5 or 10 feet below the surface of the water with your scuba equipment, Do not take a gigantic breath of air and then quickly come up or your lungs will explode. So come up nice and slowly, continue to breathe, because lungs exploding is really something that you don't want to do as a scuba diver or any point in life.
Yeah.
So could you walk me through in the beginning? I mean, submarines as a part of warfare go back a very long way. In the American Civil War, the Confederacy had the Hunley, which killed all of its crew. Famously, the U-boats in World War I, and then submarines were used to excellent effect in World War II. So with submarines, I'm sure naval strategists also had rescue protocol. Even if it wasn't possible to rescue crew, they had to have some sort of plan on the book. So can you just walk through what were ways that you would try to rescue a submarine crew if they were on the seafloor or their vessel wasn't functional?
Yeah, well, the irony was historically, it was very simple. In that what they did back in the kind of early 19th century, the pioneers of submarine were brave and strange men. And what they did was when their crew, they realized that what they could not do was effectively unscrew the hatch at when they hit 100 feet down and lift the hatch up because of the pressure of the water on the hatch. What they needed to do was they needed to flood the submarine. So before they could open that hatch, they had to fill the entire submarine with water and hold their breath. And then by equalizing the pressure, they could lift the hatch. And if they were at a depth that where this was even feasible, they could effectively swim to the surface on a single breath. There was also some of the submarines on that point. One of the men who led the rescue was working for Vickers in 1943, I think it was, or 44, when a submarine sank in Liverpool, just off the coast of Liverpool. And what happened was these submarines were built with such a way that there was escape pods, but you had to be brave. I mean, you had to sit in there and you had to wait till the water got, then you could open the hatch and then you could escape. But what would happen is if someone panicked, which was the case in Liverpool, and tried to escape too soon, he ended up drowning and scuppered it for the rest of them and they all drowned. So that was one system. I mean, the other systems were that you would have a smaller submarine that with nuclear submarines, it could effectively go down and lock onto it, and then you could transfer. But that wasn't an option with the rescue of Pisces. What they knew from the beginning was that this was so basic. They were going on a fishing expedition. What they had to do was they had to find the submarine, and then they had to attach hooks to it, and then they had, like a giant fish, they had to get it to the surface.
Okay, so this is how, because Pisces was small enough for something like a World War II submarine, you probably couldn't hook it and then pull it up.
You mean an exception, the big hook.
Right. I'm a very large dog. All right, well, please tell me about the different groups that come together, actually different nations in the Pisces story. How do they come together and what is their rescue plan?
Well, what's fascinating about it is there's Vickers, which is the home team, effectively Britain. Now, the submarine that they were in, Pisces, had been designed by Canadians. It had been designed in the kind of early 60s by a fascinating man called Al Trice. And what he had done is he was a very keen diver, both scuba, but also the old heavy helmet commercial divers. And he was on a job down at a depth of 300 feet and realized this has to be an easier way than bounce diving. So he developed the Pisces, which was the first small commercial submarine. So first of all, they phoned the Canadians, Hyco, which was the company, and they were effectively doing a similar job over in Canada, i.e. burying the cable out off the coast of Canada. So first of all, they were contacted and they said, right, yeah, we're on board. So what they did was their team phoned the Canadian Air Force. And again, it's this situation where people pulled together. The Canadian Air Force said, look, no problem. We'll have a Hercules plane waiting for you as soon as you're ready. And we'll worry about the paperwork later. They just took it on trust. I mean, they phoned up and said, there's a submarine 120 miles off the coast of Ireland. We need a Hercules. And they said, yes. And that's what I love about these stories. Everyone puts everything in when they have to. So what they then did was they got one of the smaller Pisces and they got it to the Hercules base. And within hours, they were taking off and flying towards Cork in Ireland. They also contacted the Americans. The Americans had a different system. They effectively had a remote-controlled device that they were going to bring over. And it was a similar situation. They were based in San Diego, and all the team pulled together. They got the remote-controlled submarine, And they got that on a US Army Hercules. Two of them flew off to Cork. What then? What was again fascinating about the story was that it was led by a guy called Peter Miservery, and he was a kind of naval commander. He came into the Navy just after the Second World War, and had been heavily involved in submarine development, submarine rescue. So what happened was all three groups, the Americans, the Canadians, and the British, met in Cork. Effectively, what happened was there was a surface ship called the Vickers Voyager, and it sailed, left the rescue spot, and a British naval vessel stayed on the spot where they were, and it sailed back to Cork to pick up, first of all, the Canadians. The Canadians then sailed back to the rescue spot. Now, this takes 24, almost 36 hours. And all that time, the oxygen's getting bled out. And then what they did was the Americans arrived slightly later. And when they arrived, they effectively thought that the men would be rescued by that time. But what happened was the first team gets to the surface and they go down with a smaller submarine carrying a rope. It's a polypropylene rope. And they try and calculate the buoyancy of the rope because if it's they wanted it to be buoyant enough so that it wouldn't catch. But the problem was that they didn't really calculate that it was too buoyant. So what happened was the first submarine sank down to try and find Pisces, and it gets to about 1,200 feet down, and then the buoyancy of the rope snaps. So it snaps out of the hook that they've got. All these little mini submarines have like giant claws, like crabs effectively, where they position things with. And the crab claw that was effectively holding the rope, because of the weight of the buoyancy, it pulled out. So the rope was sucked away from them effectively. So they're down there on the bottom, but without a rope to attach. Problem one. They decide to stay down there to try and find the submarine, but after a certain amount of time, they can't find it, so they have to go back up to the surface. So that's the first mission. Second mission is the Canadians. Canadians get their submarine out. The Canadians go all the way down to the bottom. Problem is they don't know where it is. So they're having to use sonar to try and find where Pisces 3 is. And the Canadians are down there for 8 hours and can't find it. So they're down there, then they have to go back up to the surface. So that's two trips down, still no success. And effectively what happens is they go back to the surface, they retune, and then the Canadians go back down again. And eventually, after Roger Mallinson and Roger Chapman singing, at one point they suggest that the first thing they do is have them count to 1 to 50. Now, bearing in mind that they have been told to conserve oxygen, just not to speak as much as possible, just to be silent. First thing is they ask them to count 1, 2, 3, all the way up to 50 in the hope that these beats can be picked up and they can better position it. Problem is, it doesn't work. They can't see them, they can't find them. The next thing is they suggest, why don't you sing? So Roger Chapman starts singing a made-up song all about how they're here, they're trapped. They really hope someone can find them. And eventually what happens is Roger Mallinson and Roger Chapman hear a differential, a kind of beat, and they think the Canadians have been repositioning their sonar, and they tell them, have they been repositioning? They reposition and they get their first click. So what happens is they lock onto them, and there's this amazing moment where when they look out the portholes, all they can see is blackness. But then what happens is the Canadians come along, and the water outside begins to become burnished gold with this light, and they're finally found. And you would think, this is amazing, they've been found, they're rescued. But really, the problems are only just beginning.
Right. So, up until this point, the two Rogers that are on the ship, Roger Chapman and Roger Mallinson,
yeah,
what are they doing to keep their sanity? And do they have any contact with the outside world or any idea that they're actually rescue vessels within range of them before this vessel is contacting them? Or what is it like for them? Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
Yeah, well, it's a very strange situation. I mean, there are two things. One, Roger Chapman is naval. He's a former Navy officer, and so he was based on submarines. So he's the kind of epitome of the British stiff upper lip. In fact, they both are in their different ways. One's kind of naval officer class, the other one's more kind of a judicious engineer, Mrs. Roger Mallinson. And the benefit is that there is this thing called the underwater telephone, effectively. So they can have a very basic communication system where they can hear the surface talking down to them, although it can be very staticky. I've got a recording of it, and it doesn't sound that great. But what's also very, very strange is that there's dolphins in the area, porpoises, and the dolphins keep making noises which interfere with the messages. So they can hear them, but it is quite difficult. So they're told what's going on. They try and keep in touch with them every hour or so, and every half hour they click the handset of the radio to let them know that they're still okay. But primarily what they're doing is they're lying very still, trying to keep as quiet as possible. They're also operating what's known as the scrubber, because what happens is because they're constantly breathing, they're breathing out carbon dioxide, and carbon dioxide has to be scrubbed out of the atmosphere effectively, and with a kind of lithium hydroxide device, which has to be operated by a kind of the ship's or the submarine's battery. So they're operating that. The problem is that when carbon dioxide builds up, you get excruciating headaches. And effectively, that's the first thing that will kill you in this circumstance. It will be the buildup of carbon dioxide. It'll not be although their oxygen will run out, and they've got about, I mean, the irony is, if they were operating as normal, their oxygen would run out in 24 to 36 hours. But because they are being as immobile as possible, they're stretching it out, and they think they can stretch it to 3 days, which is the upper limit of a potential kind of rescue operation. So they are, I mean, they're talking to each other, but they're trying to do it as little as possible.
Okay, well, the rescue vessel comes. So what's the protocol? You described earlier that you would flood it so that pressure would equalize and it would be possible to move the hatch. Do they have to...
No. That's only if you're at a depth of...
Oh, okay.
50. They're at 1,600 feet, so the pressure's 50 tons. Yeah. But also, if you imagine it, try and imagine swimming up the side of the Empire State Building. Just think how long that would take, even if you weren't crushed by the pressure. So that's not an option. What they need to do is the Canadians need to get a hook onto the top of the vessel. And what's amazing and tragic is that they come along, they get the hook, they manage to use the grapple, and they attach the hook. And the way I've described it in the book is, try and imagine you're in a suit of armour and you're threading a needle. That's kind of what the job is like. But what happens is they thread the needle, but then in some utter unlucky fluke, the hook twists and turns and then falls out the attachment. So no sooner have they got it on board, then they look up and it's fallen out the eye of the hook and is drifting away. So they have to maneuver the ship, banging into ICSD as they do so, to catch the hook. With the rope, and the problem is that when they get it back, they can't get it back onto the original lift point. They can only connect it to the propeller grill, which couldn't bear the weight. So they now know where it is, but they can't move it down onto the lift point. So they're 48 hours into this rescue. They've managed to find it, but they haven't got a rope attached. And then over the next 24 hours, there's three or four other attempts to finally get one rope down, and then the Americans are brought on board. But it's a crazy system.
So then another ship has to come down to be able to hook to the Pisces successfully.
Yeah, and another. What happens is, I mean, to kind of roll into what happens is, another team is helicoptered out in the midst of a storm. They are lowered down onto the deck of Voyager, and they take over, and they take another submarine down and manage to get the first rope on board. Now, this is at, if I remember correctly, this is about 6 a.m. The estimate was they would run out of oxygen at 10. So they get the first rope down at 10, sorry, at 6 a.m. And the estimate was that they would probably start to be passing out about 10, but they think that they might get to 12 or 1. The Americans are then brought on board with their remote-controlled submarine, and they managed to get a second rope down. And it went by sort of 10 o'clock, they've got two ropes locked down onto the submarine. But again, that's where the problems begin, because they then have to drag this submarine up from 1,600 feet. And the problem is it's swinging really violently. It's not a smooth, this is not an elevator lift. This is an elevator. If your elevator is attached to a crane and the crane is swinging it violently, at some point, so 240 degrees, at some point their concern was that they were going to be smashed to bits inside the submarine.
So they're lifting, but it's yawing significantly, kind of like your Empire State Building analogy, if it were a crane that high and you were doing that underneath the depths.
Absolutely. And also, it's also partly because the ship that they're lifting it from is going up and down on a wave. So the waves are pushing it up sort of 20 to 30 feet. And so it's almost like a fish in a line. It's been dragged up and down constantly. But they finally, the lift takes almost 2 hours to get to the surface. And then when they get to 100 feet below the surface, a diver is sent down to attach a third line. And this is an amazing guy who goes down. And the ship, he describes it, he's swimming towards a bucking bronco that's flipping back and forth. And he's carrying a hook that he manages to get on board. And I just want to, I'm trying to remember. The problem when you write a book like this, it's Bob Hanley. Bob Hanley is the diver who manages to get the final rope on board. But it's an amazing rescue operation. And it's one of these great stories that tells a story of how everyone comes together to effectively rescue Roger Mallinson and Roger Chapman.
For Chapman and Mallinson, how do they describe coming up when they're in this tiny submarine that's violently yawing? And what was it like when they finally reached the surface?
Well, both of them said that the worst part of the whole ordeal was coming to the surface, which you wouldn't think, but it was. I think it was a combination of three things. One, they didn't kind of grasp the method by which they were locked on. In their head, they saw an umbrella hook. So they felt that at any minute, it wasn't sealed, that they could come off the hook effectively, like a fish off a hook, that these violent tremors would throw them off. So that was the first thing that terrified them. They felt at any second it could go. There was also the fact that they kept having to stop, and they knew that they were down to their last gasp of oxygen. So every time they stopped, it was terrifying for them. And then finally, to get to the surface, Mallinson talks about struggling to get the hatch off and sort of lying back in the bottom of the submarine and kicking to try and get the door open. And then there's a lovely moment when they are on the surface, the hatch is open, and they have what they say is their only argument of the whole ordeal, because it's who goes first. Mallinson feels that he is the pilot, thus he is the captain, thus he should go last. Chapman is aware that Roger Mallinson cannot swim. And that's his line. He says, "Roger, you can't swim." So his concern was that at any point a wave could come, the submarine could sink again, and he was better placed to swim out from the depth that they were at, i.e. they were on the surface. So Mallinson is the first to get out, and Chapman follows. And what I'm so pleased about writing the book, and also why I'm very pleased to doing this podcast in America, is that the American team who took part, and this guys like Bob Watts, Larry Brady, Tom Wachowski, Denny Holstein, John DeFriest, William Sanderson, William Patterson, they never really got to be thanked, and they never got their due, because, as you can imagine, they get this ship to the surface, and the two Rogers were effectively put a speedboat, effectively one of these kind of inflatables, and taken back to the mothership. And when the operations take place, as soon as the operation's done, everyone goes their own separate ways. And I know that Roger Mallinson is keen to pass on his thanks to all the American team and the Canadian team. Guys like Al Trice, Mike McDonald, Jim Macbeth, Bob Starr, Bob Holland, Al Whitcomb, Steve Johnston. I mean, these were guys who came from thousands of miles away to save their life. And that's why I'm really pleased to the benefit of the book is to tell their story as well, and how they were all cogs in a machine that finally dragged them to the surface.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. Yeah, and I'd like to hear about how this story lived on, because what I was thinking as a parallel is Apollo 13, the Apollo mission two times after the first moon landing, in which there was disaster. So with the crew on board the Apollo 13, and then also Mission Control in Houston trying to engineer solutions so they don't run out in oxygen and die as well. That was captivating, but it was also part of the lunar program when there was all sorts of media attention, whereas this was an infrastructure project bearing an undersea cable. So there wasn't any media attention focused on this initial voyage because it was something routine and it didn't become a spectacle until after there was a disaster. So from when this happened, was there anyone who became sort of a celebrity, or how did this live on afterwards?
Well, it's effectively what happened was, and in fact, when I was pitching the book, I pitched it as Apollo 13 at 300 fathoms. That was my catch line, and everyone got it because it's a very similar situation with these two guys. What happened was both men became celebrities for a week, as these situations are. They had they both gave big interviews to the national press. They were interviewed, but then as these events come, they're massive stories for the duration of the story, and then within a week, it's like water has passed over it. The tide of events floods on. Roger Chapman wrote a book about it maybe 3 or 4 years later. But what was fascinating about Chapman was Chapman took the experience and then set up his own company, which specialised in submarine rescues. Now, he set up his own company and went on to have a very successful career. In fact, his company tried to help in the Kursk disaster and had a lot of equipment on the scene, but the Russians kept everyone at arm's length, tragically, for a certain point. So it lived on in that respect. And then, obviously, I decided to write the book. And the book is now being developed as a possible film.
Yeah, that would be great to see it on screen.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for sharing all this with us. And just before we wrap up, you mentioned some of the meta themes of your book, that with the law of the sea, different people will come together because they realize how treacherous work at the sea is, and your life could be at the mercy of the help of others. So that's the understanding. But are there other messages that you think come from the story that you would like readers to take?
Well, the key thing is, in these strange times, is effectively, you summed it up very nicely. There's this idea of people putting other people before them, and a collective coming together to rescue two people. It's almost that case of it cost a fortune and it involved so many people and it was all for two men. And there's something beautiful about that because, we are all worth it. If we are in danger, it's absolutely right that states, nations throw everything they can to try and rescue people and to try and get them out of danger. And I think that's a great theme of it. The other thing is almost what will you endure to survive? How tough is it to do nothing? How tough is it to effectively to lie there and endure, when there is nothing else you can do? And also the loved ones back home, how do you cope with doubt? If only you knew at the beginning of this ordeal that they will be rescued, but you don't, how do you cope with it? And that's the elements that comes through with the experience of June Chapman, who was Roger Chapman's wife and had lived through it. Same with Mallinson's wife, who had a similar experience. But I think that would be the key thing. And also there's a great quote from that comes through. Al Trice, who's a fabulous character in this and is still alive at 90-odd, when he was on the deck and the Navy were trying to fly over rope from one ship to another, and they miscalculated the weight of the rope, and the helicopter took off, and they watched through the windscreen effectively of the ship's deck as the helicopter took off and immediately started plummeting down towards the water because of the weight of the rope. So they had to drop the rope. And that was another delay as they tried to get the rope from another ship. And Al Trice said at one point, if it was easy, everyone would do it. And that was one of those moments where it was patently clear that it wasn't easy. But this is also a great book that I think could be summed up by Winston Churchill's line, never, ever, ever give up. And that was what's wonderful about this, was that at no point did those rescuers give up. And they probably felt, because literally everything that could go wrong in this rescue mission did go wrong, but they didn't give up and they got those men back from the sea.
Right. So many times that they're seeking a solution, but then there's a technical problem and it fails and they have to keep trying over and over again. Well, there's a lot more that we could have covered here, but I leave that to listeners to check out the book for themselves. And the name of the book is The Dive, The Untold Story of the World's Deepest Submarine Dive. Stephen, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Scott. Thank you to all your listeners.
All right. That is all for today's episode. As a first order of business, I need to thank the Knowlton's Rangers, and I'll explain what that is in a second. And they are Kristen Lee, Willie from New Jersey, Sumo 41, Sergeant Hooch, Wire Meets Wood Guitars at WMWGuitars.com, Bill Ivey, Tom from Ohio, Salvador Sanchez, Dane Carlson from Linwood, Washington, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael Piccinetti, Michael from New York, Jeff Mitchell, owner of Mountain West Commercial Las Vegas, Josh Reddick, Jake Harrington, Josh from BFW Post 2285, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Frieza. Now, if you'd like to support History Unplugged and help it grow, there are three easy ways to do so. First, subscribe to the show and leave a review on the podcast player of your choice. This helps other people discover the show. Second, join our Facebook group, and here you can discuss recent episodes with fellow listeners, mention what you'd like to see on the show in the future, and get way more out of the show, and just look for History Unplugged on Facebook. Third, become a member of the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were an elite reconnaissance and espionage detachment of the Continental Army established by George Washington, but it's also the membership group of History Unplugged, and here you can really dive in way deeper with the show. You can check it out by going to Patreon, patreon.com/unplugged. If you join at the Scout level, you get early access to new podcast episodes, and you get completely ad-free versions of the entire back catalog of more than 500 episodes. Plus, everything is neatly categorized, so if you want to listen to something about the Middle Ages and skip all the Civil War stuff or vice versa, you can easily find an old episode from 3 years ago that, if you're just looking on Apple Podcasts, would be buried in the feed. If you join at the Intelligence Officer level, you get all the same stuff, but access to a growing catalog of now more than 60 premium episodes that come out bi-weekly, including a multi-part series on the life of Audie Murphy, the most decorated combat soldier in World War II, a series on French Foreign Legion fighters in World War I, one on Teddy Roosevelt's years in the Dakota Badlands, and a series on Nazi attempts to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Lastly, if you join the Spymaster level, you get all the same stuff as level 1 and 2, but you also get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You can choose a historical topic on absolutely anything, and I'll base an hour-long episode on it. Plus, you get a 3-pack of hardcover books. So again, check it all out by going to patreon.com/unplug. Well, that's all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and see you next time.